Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love to God's glory and that of his kingdom. I hope you'll join us in doing just that. Check us out at securingamerica.tv. We are going to be talking about China in this segment, as we often do. We'll do so with one of the most, I think, knowledgeable, thoughtful, articulate, and influential analysts of the threat that the Chinese Communist Party represents to our country, to our allies, and to our vital interests. He has been doing it through a very long and mostly very, accomplished career in the United States Navy. As a naval intelligence officer, he rose to the rank of captain and chief of intelligence for the U.S. Pacific Fleet. These days, he is a senior fellow with the Geneva Center for Security Policy, a member of our Committee on the Present Danger of China, and a really important force for good, as I see it. His name is Captain Jim Fennell, United States Navy retired. Always welcome here, and we're delighted to have him back. Captain, thanks for joining us. Welcome aboard.
Glad to be with you, Frank. Thank you.
I wanted to talk with you about Taiwan. It's been a little bit since we've discussed it. There is a very heated debate going on here inside Washington, which people, some, I think, frankly, not so informed, suggest that Nancy Pelosi is responsible for this unpleasantness with the Chinese Communist Party over the island of Taiwan that's resulted in these exercises and live fire blockades, effectively, of the island, and the sort of intensification of a lot of other military threats from the Chinese Communist Party. Tell us what your thoughts are about the instigation of all of this and what it has told us so far about what the Chinese have in mind for Taiwan.
Well, Frank, I think, you know, this is a very contentious issue amongst people from both sides of the aisle in Washington and around the world. And it seems like a lot of people have come down and condemned the speaker's visit as being reckless. Surprisingly, more people from her own party have condemned her than from the other party. And I think that's because the people that have always been calling out for confronting China saw her visit as being a way to confront China and to stand up against what they perceive, and we all perceive and know, to be an outrageous way of acting. It's in violation of all international norms to use violence to threaten people to obey you. And so the fact that
including
she went
there, the threat to shoot down her aircraft.
Correct. That's even the most outrageous thing of this. But she went, and you now read these assessments from people that, you know, this caused this. Well, no, that's not true. I stand with Gordon Chang and others who have said that the Chinese have been on a timeline. I've been talking about this decade of concern, and we are in the middle of this decade of concern where China is fomenting to take Taiwan back. And like I said, they prefer to use non-kinetic means, but what we've seen in this last week is a demonstration of their ability to use kinetic measures to take Taiwan by physical force.
Something, so give us your professional judgment of what we have seen and whether that now actually suggests they're ready to do it.
I think the PLA was ordered by, I think, Jiang Zemin. We know Hu Jintao and Xi Jinping ordered the PLA to be ready to take Taiwan by 2020. That's 2 years ago. So I think that they had a capability 2 years ago to be able to conduct an invasion. Now, how successful, that's another story. But for the last 2 years, their spike in the growth of their Navy, for instance, has been dramatic. Same with their Air Force, same with their Strategic Rock Force. So what we watched from the previous 20 years of military modernization was a trend line like this. And in the last 2 years, it's gone almost vertical. And so I believe that the Chinese now are actually doing dress rehearsals. And what we've seen over the last week is a dress rehearsal. And each element of their military is preparing and working together. They talked about their theater, Eastern Theater Commander, having a joint logistics and a joint theater command center stood up to run joint logistics, to run joint fires, to integrate air and naval platforms over the same airspace and to deconflict that from strategic rockets, ballistic missiles that are coming in all around Taiwan. And so they've circled Taiwan with rocket firing, hypersonic missiles possibly. We still don't have confirmation of that, but there's been some speculation. And they've done that while there's been naval forces and air forces operating east of Taiwan, north of Taiwan, south of Taiwan, and they've completely obliterated the perceived center line inside the Taiwan Strait. That doesn't exist anymore. I mean, it exists in a physical sense, but it doesn't exist in reality. Chinese military, the PLA, is never going to respect the center line ever again. And we saw yesterday even crossings of the center line, or the day before, crossings of the center line by at least 16 combat aircraft from the PRC. That's an unprecedented number that we would never have seen before. Prior to the, you know, a year or two ago, we would have not seen that. It only occurred on a handful of occasions in the past 50 years, and now it's a routine basis. And today, China has said the Eastern Theater Command of the PLA will organize regular combat patrols in the Taiwan region. And that's now, you have to take that language with regular combat patrols equate to what they just did this week. They're not saying they're going to go back to patrols that they had in 2020 or 2015. They're issuing this statement today saying what we just did from 4 to 7 August around Taiwan, that is now a combat patrol with our air forces, naval forces, and rocket forces. And we're going to routinely do this. And so what does that
mean? You call this the new normal.
It is the new normal, and we can expect that new normal just to continue to go up. So the noose is getting tighter and tighter around Taiwan's neck, and it demands that we do something about it.
I want to come back to that thought in a moment. But Jim, just again, as an intelligence professional, one of the things that I'm struck by that I don't think it's getting anywhere near the attention that it really deserves is this new normal puts the mainland basically on a war footing in close proximity to Taiwan and enables it essentially at will to begin, certainly suppressing fire, if not the actual invasion. And indicators and warnings is something that people like you have, you know, lived and breathed to try to make sure that policymakers and military leaders and forces are able to respond in a timely way to, you know, very dangerous developments like this. What does the new normal do to essentially suppress those indicators and warnings and make the job of your successor, for example, at the Pacific Fleet and others, vastly more difficult?
Yeah, Frank, that's an excellent point. I mean, there are indications and warning at the strategic, operational, and tactical levels of warfare. And I would say we clearly now at the strategic level, and I would say at the operational level, we know what's coming. We know what the PRC intends to do. They intend to take Taiwan by military force. But because of this new normal of their operations around Taiwan with their Navy, with their Air Force, with nuclear submarines, with ballistic missiles, with joint cyber capabilities, that this is now on, it's so close to Taiwan and it's on such a ramped up basis that it makes the ability for intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance forces to keep track of all this and report it up and distinguish between, is this just another training run or is this the real thing? I use this example. If I do this at your face, we're not together physically, but if I was to be with you and I did this to your face, at first you'd back up. But if I did it for 5 days in a row, if I did it for 5 months in a row, if I did it for another year in a row, every day, you like that every hour, at some point you wouldn't flinch. You'd stop flinching. And that's the risk that we have now.
Very much so. Hold the thought, Jim. We're going to come back with more with Captain Jim Fennell, United States Navy retired premier analyst of the Chinese Communist Party threat right after this.
Thank you.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. On Friday, the House of Representatives is expected to authorize the hiring of 87,000 armed IRS investigators, supposedly to pursue corporate and wealthy tax cheats. In fact, under President Biden, this doubling of that agency's current workforce of 90,000 employees will amount to a huge new cohort empowered to use not only unwarranted audits to intimidate and penalize perceived political foes. Recent events suggest they'll also constitute a vast paramilitary force available to perpetrate the sorts of raid mounted at President Trump's home earlier this week. Some Democratic partisans are quibbling about the use of the term raid to characterize what went down at Mar-a-Lago. Ask yourself, if 40 federal agents wielding weapons and a search warrant they won't let you see came to your house, what would you call it, aside from a terrifying violation of your constitutional rights? This is Frank Gaffney. We're back. We're continuing a tremendously important conversation with Captain James Fennell, United States Navy, retired former Chief of Intelligence for the U.S. Pacific Fleet, a very close and highly regarded, well, observer and analyst of what the Chinese Communist Party's military capabilities and, to the best they can be discerned, intentions are. And we've been talking with him a bit about what they've done of late, having seized upon the pretext of Nancy Pelosi's visit to the island of Taiwan to ramp up dramatically their capacity to threaten the island, perhaps with invasion, certainly with a blockade, and to do so, as we were just discussing with Captain Fennell, with very little warning that they're moving into a new and very much more aggressive phase. And Jim, as you just sort of touched on a moment ago, this may well eventuate fairly quickly. We're well into what you called a decade of concern. I know elsewhere you've indicated that your assessment of how fast all of this might begin to be brought to bear against Taiwan, this invasion or blockade or other kinds of coercive techniques, I think by perhaps as much as 2 years. Comment on that if you would, and then let's turn to what must the United States do to try to prevent that, and are we capable of doing it? Start with your assessment of how imminent this all might be at this point.
Right, Frank. The idea that we can just wait and kick this down this can down the road continually forever is false. It's just now just too obvious that they have the capabilities and they have the desire, and they're telling us by every method available that they want Taiwan to knuckle under, and they're using the military. They have a military that's capable. And so when I see Department of Defense officials in the last 24, 48 hours say that they don't think there's any likelihood of an imminent invasion in the next 2 years, I have to ask myself, is that really an intelligence assessment or is that a political statement trying to de-escalate tensions? Because there's a belief that if you speak truthfully about what's going on, that will escalate things. And so I see that we're once again dominated by political leadership that I experienced in the Obama administration personally while I was in uniform, that had a policy of do not provoke the PRC. So even in this situation where China is threatening to shoot down the Speaker of the House's airplane, where they're firing ballistic missiles at a civilian population in Taiwan that could possibly hit
over the island.
And if there had been a malfunction of any one of those missiles, it could have rained down and killed people. It also came close to American ships, warships, and our own sailors. Now, there wasn't anything, a serious close call, but that's in the region. And it also went inside Japanese exclusive economic zone. So you have a very violent, gross act of wanton violence by the PRC, and yet our administration saying, well, we better not say anything that they could invade in the next 2 years because that could escalate it. Wake up.
Jim, I know that one of the things that I think prompted your separation from the Navy was this frustration about not only that kind of political, well, diktat, I guess it's fair to say, unconnected to the underlying realities.
Right. There's
Is that likely to be what's happening now to men and women in uniform who are basically on point in dealing with these threats, that they're being told, hey, there's really nothing to worry about here for the next 2 years? If that's the case, surely they're not, you know, putting themselves in a position to contend with this problem properly, are they?
I think the people that at all echelons recognize the threat, to be honest, I think they know it. But I think people like Colin Call, who's in the DOD right now, they go back to their offices and say, if we say anything, this could start the war, so we better not say anything. And no one is, there's never a counter argument that says, what if we don't say the right things and we don't stand up and show that we're determined to defend Taiwan? Will that be a green light to Beijing? That side of it is rarely ever argued. It may be argued, but it's never seriously considered. And so we have a pattern of passivity and we keep doing the same thing, but things never get better. So we're at a point now where if we continue this much longer, we're going to be in a situation like we saw in the Korean War, like we saw at Desert Storm, and we're in a position where China's going to say they're not going to react. And we saw it in the Ukraine as well.
Yeah. Jim, I guess what I'm getting at is that there's not only the problem of the Colin Calls, who is now the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy and who has been deeply compromised by the Chinese Communist Party over the years, as has our commander-in-chief, for that matter. That's enough of a problem, it seems to me, with respect to Chinese calculations about whether to move against Taiwan or not. But if in addition, they must be thinking, if the Defense Department and, you know, the other elites in Washington are saying, we're not going to do anything for 2 years, let's seize the day and take advantage of what will probably be a lower level of readiness on the part of our folks, as I say, forward deployed to contend with such a problem, because they're being told, you know, nothing to worry about. And this brings me to a topic that we touched on earlier this week. Jim, you were a very important contributor to one of our Committee on the Present Danger China webinars about the threats that the Chinese Communist Party, represent to us, but also the degree to which the Biden administration's takedown of the United States military is contributing to, well, not only our lack of preparedness to contend with the Chinese, but probably their perception, as I say, that they can seize the day decisively, perhaps, given the disarray in our armed forces. Talk us through your assessment of how ready we are to contend with this threat as it's now emerging.
Well, from a material standpoint, we're clearly in a position of inferiority to the PRC. They have more ships, more anti-ship cruise missiles, more ballistic missiles, and they're in concentration in one area, in the area that they want to fight. And we're spread around the world, and so that's one area. We've had problems with material readiness and the conditions of our ships and the conditions of the training of our crews. And in the last 18 months, we've seen an infusion of woke ideology and other things that have nothing to do with war fighting, even though that's what they're purported to help, but we know they don't. And so I think there's an issue that we need to seriously look at, is the morale of the people that are still left, and what is their ability to resist or fight when they're in a situation where essentially, you know, you said that the forces that we have in the Far East right now, they're there. The Lincoln is operating right now. We've got amphibious strike groups that are operating, or carrier or amphibious ready groups that are operating right now east of Taiwan. They're in harm's way. Those are good people. They want to do the right thing, but their political leaders are putting their lives at risk by not standing up and saying, we're not going to put up with this and we're going to do something about it, other than saying, we don't think there's going to be an invasion in 2 years. That's the really dangerous thing about this.
It is indeed. And again, it just feeds into concerns about the leadership that our forces are getting from their civilian, as well as, frankly, their military commanders, and the extent to which all of that is emboldening the Chinese to believe that they can act with impunity, whether honestly, Jim, as we've talked about on this program and elsewhere before, not just against Taiwan, but against us, perhaps, as well, our assets, our personnel, as you mentioned, our territory. And the danger that it seems to me that is now being exacerbated by all of this is we may be blundering into an avoidable war, a war that could be deterred by the combination of a lack of readiness and this kind of, malfeasant leadership is, I guess, the way I would put it, some of it compromised by the Chinese Communist Party. Jim Fennell, thank you for your service to our country over all these years that you're continuing to render, not least as a member of our Committee on the Present Danger of China. We so appreciate the work you do, Jim, and the insights that you bring to bear on this program and elsewhere is simply indispensable at this moment. And I want to commend you for it and thank you again and hope that you will be joining us in the very near future. Once again. Next up, Dr. Stephen Hatfield will talk about yet another disease the Chinese are cooking up in the Wuhan Institute of Virology, what it might mean for you, right after this.
Night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. I'm always delighted to be able to say welcome to our next guest. He is a remarkable, national treasure, to my way of thinking. He has devoted most of his professional life a threat that we have now, experienced firsthand with a loss of about a million Americans to date, namely biological warfare. His name is Dr. Stephen Hatfield. He's a medical doctor and has a whole host of postgraduate degrees. He has worked in America's biological defense programs at Fort Detrick, among other places. He has been a duty expert for presidents, including Donald Trump, when we faced the COVID-19 pandemic in 2020. He has been, I'm very proud to say, a member of an extraordinary group of people that we put together to study the origins of that so-called SARS-CoV-2 virus that prompted this COVID pandemic, called Team B3. And his work in that study helped us categorically say this virus came out of a weapons laboratory and its dissemination by the Chinese Communist Party purposefully, deliberately, knowingly to us and the rest of the world was a biological warfare attack. Dr. Hatfield, it's good to have you back, sir. We've got a pressing reason to catch up with you, and I'm very appreciative of you finding the time to be with us. The pressing reason for wanting to touch base is our friend and longtime colleague, Bill Gertz, who writes the Inside the Ring column at the Washington Times, and arguably the best journalist in the country on the defense beat. Covered a hearing in the United States Senate last week, August 3rd, I believe it was, in which a doctor by the name of Stephen Quay testified that he discovered evidence on a website of the Wuhan Institute of Virology to the effect that the Chinese were pursuing a far more deadly disease than SARS-CoV-2. Something called Nephi. Tell us what you know about this disease and about the prospects that a biological weapons lab like the Wuhan Institute of Virology could be up to no good in connection with it.
Yeah, sure. First of all, Dr. Quay is a very credible researcher, very credible at forensic genetics. The Nephi virus, we've known about this for about 20 years. It was first discovered in Malaysia, where it had attacked the pig industry and species jump into man. It's a member of the a group of viruses, including the Hendra virus, which was discovered in Australia earlier than the Nipah virus. Both of these are quite lethal. China has a new outbreak right now, a small number of cases of another virus in this family. 35 cases so far, mild illness, not transmitted easily person to person. But China's showing us what a good neighbor they are by rapidly reporting this to the WHO. When they failed,
unlike what they did.
Yeah, when they failed to do so for weeks, months with the SARS-CoV-2 virus.
So if the Chinese Wuhan Institute of Virology is engaged in, as Dr. Quay has testified, gain of function research techniques and funding for which, sadly, our own Dr. Fauci and his organization provided them, what could they possibly be up to concerning this virus and perhaps making it more transmissible to other humans? And what's the lethality of it?
It carries a fairly high lethality, anywhere from 30% or higher.
I've seen numbers as high as 80%. Does that sound possible?
Yeah. Again, like anything with comorbidities, this and that, viral infections are worse for an individual, depending on what's wrong with you before you get infected.
Yeah.
So it's nothing to play with. Can it be weaponized? One has to keep in mind that not every virus out there can be stabilized in an aerosol, which is the preferred means of attack. It's a difficult process. It requires a team of researchers to do this. There's usually additives that have to be developed to stabilize the virus in an aerosol. And this additive mix are closely guarded secrets, and it's different for each type of virus. And some have just not been able to be weaponized, like the hantavirus. The Russians tried for several years to stabilize it and were unable to do so. So with that said, as we've seen with the SARS-CoV-2 and COVID-19, if you have a highly infectious agent, you don't have to disseminate it as an aerosol. You can disseminate your infected people to another country and transmit it that way.
And this is what was so worrying about that biological warfare attack of 2020, ongoing. It was a proof of concept, wasn't it, for that kind of delivery mechanism. And proved to be very effective. And that's with a transmissible disease, yes, but one that was not as deadly as this one would be. I said Nephi earlier, meant Nipah. This was compared, this possibility that it could be aerosolized by Dr. Quay, I believe, to the Black Plague, only even more deadly than it. And would you say that's a over-the-top characterization of what we might be looking at here if it were to be unleashed, say, in a country like ours?
Well, if you could stabilize it as an aerosol and disseminate it in the right particle size over a target under ideal meteorological conditions, such an attack could kill a city.
But if it were done through the human transmission mechanism that we saw employed, and you've told us that you actually have had reports that the Chinese subsidized elderly people from Wuhan to go visit their family and friends in the United States.
This was no accident,
comrade, as they say.
No, they knew this was person-to-person transmissible. And some of our health leaders at the time should have realized that this was transmissible.
Right. And you were there when Donald Trump was saying, you know, we're not going to allow more of these people to come here.
Yeah, it was the correct thing to do. I was there in 2014 when we wanted to stop people from West Africa coming in during the Ebola crisis. And it was overridden. And what did we end up with? The case of Ebola on U.S. soil.
Right.
We dodged a bullet there.
We sure did. Doctor, let me ask you about this, because dodging the bullet is something we better be about if this Nipah threat materializes. One of the really important recommendations that you had in our Team B report, and by the way, folks, it's called The CCP is at War with America, and it can be downloaded for free at ccpatwar.com, and I strongly urge you to take a look at it. But one of your important recommendations, born of a lot of hard experience with the COVID pandemic response, is we need to get back to proven, more effective means of dealing with such threats than the so-called China model, which we adopted pretty much fully. Walk us through both what we did wrong in that regard, sir, and what we need to do right now, especially.
We started off on the right foot with COVID-19. We had an effective drug that was cheap. It $11 for a course of treatment if it was given to a patient early with COVID-19. That would prevent hospitalization anywhere between 50 to 80% of cases. We had a distribution. We had the drug that had been put into the national stockpile. The plan in March was going ahead full strength. The idea is to keep the case numbers low. So this was all underway. We were concentrating on several areas in the country. The New York mega region was taking the most resources. They were totally unprepared for anything. And it was down to local authorities, down to local neighborhoods, to identify these cases, get them into local neighborhood help centers, get them treated early and quarantined at home. And this was changed by a handful of people in the federal government into the absurd notion that we could vaccinate our way out of this mess.
And lock down and put masks on people and have social distancing, that whole China model. Dr. Hatfield, this is a really important topic to which I hope we can return with you soon. We're out of time for today, alas, but I think what you described as the proper plan for responding to a pandemic, which was initially adopted by President Trump and then sabotaged, is where we're going to start that next conversation with you. Thank you, sir, for all your service to our country, including as a member of Team B3. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon, and we'll pick this topic up at that time. God bless you, my friend. Dr. Peter McCullough is up next from CPAC, right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. On Friday, the House of Representatives is expected to authorize the hiring of 87,000 armed IRS investigators, supposedly to pursue corporate and wealthy tax cheats. In fact, under President Biden, this doubling of that agency's current workforce of 90,000 employees will amount to a huge new cohort empowered to use not only unwarranted audits to intimidate and penalize perceived political foes. Recent events suggest they'll also constitute a vast paramilitary force available to perpetrate the sorts of raid mounted at President Trump's home earlier this week. Some Democratic partisans are quibbling about the use of the term raid to characterize what went down at Mar-a-Lago. Ask yourself, if 40 federal agents wielding weapons and a search warrant they won't let you see came to your house, what would you call it, aside from a terrifying violation of your constitutional rights? This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. I am thrilled to say we are joined by one of my personal heroes, I think for many Americans at this moment. His name is Dr. Peter McCullough. He's the author of this book, co-author of this book, The Courage to Face COVID-19, Preventing Hospitalization and Death While Battling the Biopharmaceutical Complex. He has been at the forefront of the effort to have truth told about the nature of the virus that we've been afflicted by, so-called SARS-CoV-2 virus and the COVID pandemic that it spawned. He has been, I think, a mentor to and inspiration to countless doctors across this country and around the world. And he is leading the fight now, as he says, to prevent hospitalization and death that have already taken roughly a million of our countrymen and women. Dr. McCullough, you are one great American. I thank you for joining us. I thank you for what you do every day. I don't have time to get into all of your credentials. Suffice it to say, without exception, every public event I've been in, every media show that I've participated in, and I think that I've seen, at some point, somebody evokes and invokes Peter McCullough as an authority. So I stipulate, you know what you're talking about.
Thank you.
So I want to get a couple of questions done in the space of a very short time. One is there any doubt in your mind that what we are contending with is not a freak of nature, it is a man-engineered biological agent unleashed on our country?
The engineering of SARS-CoV-2 is memorialized in two papers. First author is Mena Cherry. The senior author is Ralph Barrick. The authors are from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Other Americans, funded by the National Institutes of Health. Some Chinese contributions. So there are a few Chinese authors. The work was American work carried out in the Wuhan Institute of Virology.
With American technology.
With American know-how.
Know-how
and technology.
And American funding.
In fact, Frank, animal models were created with human respiratory epithelium. The spike protein harvested from bats in a bat cave in China were engineered to be more lethal and invasive, mounted on a nucleocapsid, and transmissible. And in these papers, the threat, SARS-CoV-2, was being worked on along with monoclonal antibodies and the response at that time killed vaccines. And in the title of the paper is The Emergence of SARS-CoV-2 in Human Populations. It's there, it's in the published literature, it's not a cover. 2015.
Now we're told, Dr. McCullough, that the reason for doing all of that was to create vaccines that would protect us. You said killed vaccine was part of that for a time, as
right.
were monoclonal antibodies.
Right.
So where did this mRNA gene therapy vaccine get into the mix? And was the pursuit of it a justification for creating this monster?
The architect of the Wuhan Institute of Virology Biosecurity Annex was Stéphane Bancel, He's in our book. Stéphane Bainzel is a French billionaire. He was working with bioMérieux. They helped build the lab in Wuhan, China. In 2015, he leaves bioMérieux and joins a one-person company in Cambridge, Massachusetts, Moderna. The same person who helped build the Wuhan lab now joins the company that's going to provide the solution, a messenger RNA vaccine. In fact, co-owning the patent with the National Institutes of Health. So this is a government, private operation that was ongoing partnership going on for years.
And the purpose, just so I'm clear, the purpose of it was to have a reason to get people to buy a vaccine in which this fellow had been deeply invested, obviously. But I'm asking a larger question. In your mind, as a practitioner of ethical medicine, is there ever any justification for creating some viral disease just so you have an antidote to it, maybe?
Well, listen, there are programs. So the NIH has BARDA. I know because I've chaired data safety monitoring boards for BARDA, which deals with biological threats. The military has DARPA, which deals with military threats, and they have programs. So they're actually working on a threat and the solution to protect Americans. So there's an Aspergillus program, an anthrax program, a smallpox, monkeypox program, a Marburg program, an Ebola program.
All of them diseases okay. that exist in the world.
Right, but the idea is they could be biological threats. So this one, after SARS, one, which there was not a program for, I believe there was a thought that we should have a program, we should have a coronavirus program. Ralph Baric, who's the senior author of these papers, his first publication on coronavirus was 1997, so he was deeply invested. So whether this was a protective government, U.S. government military NIH program to protect Americans, or whether it was something else, it obviously went bad because the virus came out of the lab and, boys, it turned the world upside down.
And people have profited immensely.
And people have profited, but not because of commercial sales. It's because through the declaration of medical emergencies, this biopharmaceutical complex we have in the book has figured out a way. And that includes the World Economic Forum, the CEPI, the Center for Epidemic Preparedness and Innovation, the Gates Foundation, Wellcome Trust, the Rockefeller Foundation, the EcoHealth Alliance, Gavi, NIH, CDC, FDA, Bloomberg's. This complex has found a way to avoid commercial sales, to actually take a shortcut. They directly drain treasuries through pre-purchase of products.
By governments.
No commercial sales needed.
Yeah. And then you get the governments mandating the vaccines so that their sales will be that much greater.
And the pre-purchase amounts even go further. And not only that, but the governments pick up the development cost. So you can imagine the largesse of any company that's on the receiving end of the biopharmaceutical complex.
And then they get, from that same government, immunity from any kinds of suits that might flow their
okay,
way
so
because of the problems. And we have to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to ask you about the problems. I want to ask you about the truth of what is happening to us and the fact that people like yourself who have been trying to tell it are being so comprehensively suppressed that the vast majority of us still don't know what is actually going on here. We're going to discuss all of that and more with Dr. Peter McCullough, one great American medical practitioner and human being. We're going to have the privilege of talking with him a bit further on the other side of a very short break, specifically about what is the truth that you're being denied. Dr. Peter McCullough is in the house still. We're here at CPAC in Dallas, Texas, recording this program with a man that, as I said, I admire tremendously for his leadership, among other things, in medicine, but now most importantly in the public health policy, public health debate. Dr. McCullough, you were among those who recognized that there were ways to treat this particular SARS-CoV-2 virus very effectively, very inexpensively, very quickly, using known safe means. Why didn't we do that?
From the very beginning, there was a duty to treat. There was a duty to treat.
Of course, that's
and
the
there's a duty, and if the doctor can't treat it, a duty to refer. That's the first point. The second point is there's always a community standard of care. The very first doctor who attempts to do anything to help a patient establishes that community standard of care, then other things. So the doctors who were treating patients created the standard of care. And it involved using multi-purpose drugs, safe and effective, originally hydroxychloroquine, and then ivermectin, but also budesonide, prednisone, colchicine, aspirin, heparins.
Well-established.
Yeah,
safe,
and no single drug.
Used for other purposes in many cases, but very effective with this.
Very effective. In fact, dozens of governments use these products first line. It's in their guidelines, okay? So not controversial. What is controversial is when state medical boards begin to actually suppress the standard of care, when the NIH, CDC, and FDA attempt to suppress the care, when the AMA came out and launched campaigns against doing this. All those suppressing treatment, Frank, did so in order to advance the vaccines.
Tell us how that works.
There was a relationship between the suppression of early treatment and promoting the vaccines. Anybody who worked to suppress early treatment was at the same time implicitly or explicitly promoting the vaccines, which went far beyond the original intent. They were originally supposed to protect the high risk, and then it kept creeping and creeping and creeping, and most recently down to children 6 months of age.
I want to come back to that. I understood, correct me if I'm wrong, that they only could get to the vaccines, emergency use authorization, if there were no other treatments available, so that the suppression was actually not just to help the vaccines, but to make it possible to begin their use and then ultimately their mandated use.
That may not be true, because the vaccines would only be indicated to prevent COVID in somebody who hasn't had. So the indication for vaccine is prevention. The treatments would actually be indicated to treat acutely sick people. So there are two different sets of treatments. Remember, hydroxychloroquine had the very first emergency use to treat, then remdesivir, and then as an outpatient, we actually had bamlanivimab before the vaccines. So it wasn't a technicality. The reason why this was done is even worse, Frank. Suppressing early treatment was to create fear and to create suffering and hospitalization and death, to create the accepting market.
And give governments the excuse to mandate.
Right, we have nothing else to do.
Coming back to the mandate, because I think this is the most scandalous aspect of this. The mandate has required the ignoring as well as the suppressing of information about the real dangers of these mRNA gene therapies. Talk to us about that. You've been raising the alarm about it. Bobby Kennedy Jr. and Robert Malone and others have as well, but how is it that we got to a point where our government, point one, our media, point two, and, you know, our businesses, Big Pharma most especially, have been lying to us about the dangers associated with these vaccines?
The US FDA is in an active cover-up on this safety issue. We know this because court-ordered documents forced Pfizer to release what they knew. Pfizer knew about
withheld for 75
right.
years.
Pfizer knew about 1,223 deaths within 90 days of their vaccine, and the lawyer for the FDA wanted to suppress that for 55 years. We know we've got a vaccine problem because 80% of the deaths are linked to specific lots. They're not randomly allocated. We've got a product problem here, and a large number of people are dying.
When we have a product problem of much smaller scale in the past, we took these things off the market, right?
Right.
Why didn't we this time?
Because the FDA and the biopharmaceutical complex want to extend this to the greatest extent it can before this is discovered. And so this idea of mandate it, take more of them every 6 months, just keep this product flowing and keep it covered up as long as they want. Okay, Ken.
Is the FDA part of the biopharmaceutical complex? Are they a wholly owned or regulatorily captured entity?
Yeah, and the method of capture is interesting. There is certainly money that flows between pharma and the FDA, but the method of capture is the future job of FDA officials. So, you know, FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb is now on the board of Pfizer. Stephen Hahn is now on the venture capital firm funding Moderna. Rick Bright, who is blocking hydroxychloroquine to America, he joins the Rockefeller Foundation. So these guys know their future. The revolving door. They know their future is with Big Pharma.
I want to talk about their present, though. In cases like Fauci, we've been hearing a lot about effectively self-dealing, conflicts of interest, having patents or having, you know, royalties from patents or whatever. How much of a contributing factor is that?
I think relatively little. You know, the NIH staffers, they can hold patents. What they have actually done is they have actually have a conflict of interest in their intellectual stake. And we know this because Deborah Birx came out and said, oh, we knew these vaccines weren't going to work. When she said that we knew they weren't going to work, that means they took an intellectual stake that harmed large numbers of Americans.
Harmed, and in a million cases, we're told, killed them.
Well, you know, under a testimony, I back estimated, based on advancements in the learning curve, of the million deaths, we could have saved 2/3.
This is the piece of this that makes it the greatest scandal of all time, as far as I'm concerned.
I agree.
And the fact that people like you, who knew what was going on and who tried desperately to warn the rest of us to stop this train wreck, were suppressed, or canceled, or punished. Many of them have, like yourself, I think, been threatened with losing licenses. I mean, this just adds to the scandal, and it makes all the greater the value, the courage,
that's
the
right,
importance of your work.
That's
thank
right.
You,
thank
sir,
you
for joining us.
Thank
God
you,
bless
Frank.
You.
God bless
soon.
You.
Thanks to all of you for joining us for this edition of Securing America. We look forward to doing so with you again. What am I doing? This is the second program. Look forward to doing so again tomorrow, sometime next.